Gathering storm, unworthy though we are, leave us living safe and warm and sheltered in your arms. Fallen out of grace are we, sinless to be. Deliver us from the gathering storm.
Good morning and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. That was Hazel Dickens singing The Gathering Storm from the soundtrack for the movie Matewan. I'm Patricia Kohlberg and I will be your host this morning for an hour of views, reviews, and interviews from the ground up. Today I want to start by condemning the slaughter going on in the Middle East. Howard Zinn once said, quote, "We need to decide that we will not go to war, whatever reason is conjured up by the politicians or the media, because war in our time is always indiscriminate, a war against innocents, a war against children." Next Monday morning, the Moles will take a closer look at the U.S. role in fomenting violence between Israel and Palestine. Before we launch today's show, I want to talk about community radio. When you're looking for the deeper story from a radical perspective about issues that you care about, the Old Mole and other public affairs programs at KBOO are a welcome alternative to commercial media. At KBOO, we are in the final week of our fall membership drive, and it's the perfect time to donate, since your dollars will be doubled by a generous group of KBOO supporters who have pledged up to $14,000 in matching funds. To donate, you can go to kboo.fm/give, text KBOO to 44321, or click on the donate button on your KBOO app. Today, we begin with Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker talking about the push to recriminalize drugs in Oregon. After that, Bill Resnick speaks with Jennifer Berkshire about the long and sordid history of right-wing attempts to undermine public education. And we'll close out with a review by movie moles Joe Clement and Jan Hocken of one of the great labor films of all time, Matewan. Measure 110, which decriminalized drugs in Oregon, has been proclaimed a failure. Those who wish to recriminalize drugs point to the current epidemic of opiate overdoses. In September, however, the prestigious Journal of the American Medical Association published a study showing that Measure 110 is not the driving force behind the rise in drug-related deaths. So what's the real story? Here's our Left in the Law team, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker, to give you the scoop.
In November 2020, Oregon voters passed Measure 110 by a sizable majority, making personal drug possession a lower-level violation and setting up a network of drug treatment programs around the state to create new addiction recovery centers. Since the laws roll out in 2021, the programs created by Measure 110, including its governing board, have faced a series of daunting problems and now face public and police calls for recriminalizing drug use. So, Mike, where would you start in diagnosing the ills of Measure 110 and the complaints of its critics?
Well, the critics are largely people who have been, who feel dispossessed. They were the people who owned the drug problem, who had profited greatly by it. The whole role of the police has taken a tremendous expansion over the last 50 years because of the drug wars. And this is a step against, or rather away from, letting the police deal with the drug problem. the way they're going about it is, well, in two or three ways. One way is just purely deceptive. They're arguing that there's an increase in deaths and overdoses and that crime, a great increase in crime. These are simply not true, or they are easily explained. It's true, there are 20% more overdose deaths in Oregon from 2022 to 2021, rather the reverse. But in the state of Washington, there were 28% increase. There have been increases in overdoses all over the country, and nowhere else do they have a decriminalization to blame.
Some of that is the convergence of availability of fentanyl, which is a highly addictive and potentially lethal drug, cheap out on the streets, the effects of the pandemic and homelessness around the housing crisis. So there's a convergence of forces that make this problem seem more amplified, maybe more visible, and the suffering also more visible. So I think some of it's not just the police, but how the public, particularly people who spend time downtown, but maybe people who just catch a glimpse of it with images online, that visible drug, heavy drug use and its impact as people's lives and bodies are falling apart are more on display than in times past.
Well, that's very true. And that's why these false arguments are gaining traction, because people go downtown and they see things they hadn't seen 5 years ago. But the truth is, the larger reasons that you are giving, those are the reasons why. And as well as it's immeasurable. It's a kind of problem like predicting the weather or the direction of interest rates. We simply don't know all the reasons why these things are happening. But we do know that they're happening everywhere, and that the passage of this law had nothing to do with that increase. And in fact, by the way, the fact that it means there are fewer people being released from prison, fewer people incarcerated in the first place. A release from prison is when you are 10 times more likely to die of an overdose. Fewer people are being released, and it's quite possible this law has kept the numbers down. Why the state of Washington is almost half again as many drug overdoses. But you're right, there, the traction comes from visibility. And that's a problem, I think. It's caused by homelessness primarily, the fact that we simply don't have nearly enough residences in this state. People who would feel much better about using drugs behind closed doors are forced to do their drug things outdoors because they have no place to retreat to.
Of course, the suffering generated by the war on drugs and the history of criminalizing drug use is also not visible to people. And so I think the defenders of decriminalization initiatives here and elsewhere speak of how much suffering and trauma is generated through incarceration, and often people who are cited or charged with minor drug use or hard drug use then end up in prison, and their fates are profoundly affected, including often losing a chance of employment, losing often housing opportunities, families falling apart, losing the right to vote in many cases with felony cases. And you know, you don't see the surge of outrage about that kind of suffering, partly because I guess one of the functions of the criminal justice system in prisons is to keep these problems out of view of many people.
It's also, it remains structurally racist to the core. The whole war on drugs, studies have repeatedly shown that Black or brown people are from 2 to 4 times more likely to be arrested than white people who consume drugs at roughly the same rate. And that structural racism is something that is relieved by the getting rid of the criminal justice element, because it's the whole criminal justice system is founded on that kind of racism.
Yeah, and I'd like to also talk some about the campaign around Measure 110 and the enthusiasm and hopes and ideals attached to it, of course, was part of the mass mobilization of people around the murder of George Floyd, the Black Lives Matter movement, and these campaigns to curtail the police. And there's always, of course, hopes and promises of new laws that fail to fulfill, you know, the campaigns around them. And do you see this as similar to many of the progressive laws? You know, there's the climate clean energy fund that has struggled because often they're not supported by larger agencies in the state. Here, the legislature has directed the Oregon Health Authority to support the governing board in these programs, step in more, because they've really been tasked with this enormous job of a network around the state and training people to take on work and with varying levels of training and background. And so there's sometimes, I think, a way in which these progressive laws that are passed are almost set up to fail or don't have enough grounding under them to succeed.
Well, partly that's the way Oregon works. Oregon has a libertarian streak, and it shows both for better and for worse, or in both sides of what's happening. That libertarian streak has supported the passage of the first decriminalization bill for hard drugs in the whole country.
Like we were one of the first to decriminalize marijuana. Yeah, so.
But at the same time, we are dead last in supporting treatment for people who are already addicted. And we are already skeptical of any, quote, bureaucracy that is set up in order to treat people. So there needs to be a kind of deep follow through here and recognizing that addiction is a very deep-rooted problem. It's a fundamental problem that flows from inequities in our system and shortfalls in social, spiritual, material ways that we can't really predict all of, and they're going to be hard to work with. It's going to be difficult to treat all the people who need treatment successfully for a host of different reasons. But it can be done. It can be, the sharp blade can be blunted of addiction, and it takes patience and effort and intelligence. And I guess that boils down to fundamentally, who do you want to deal with this problem? Do you want police officers to deal with it? Or do you want doctors, nurses, social workers to deal with it? Do you want people who are aimed specifically, who are treated and trained for this type of treatment? Or do you want people whose whole experience is fundamentally based in dealing with lawbreaking of a more serious kind or a more direct kind, more violent kind, and to have them deal with people who are addicted?
Yeah, there's some of the commentary by defenders of Measure 110 who made similar arguments. The basic issue here is the impulse to punish people for drug use, and that the police are seen as a way of punishing people and talking about consequences. People have to have consequences, even though there's substantial social science and medical research that suggests that concludes that involuntary coercive treatment for drug addiction is not only not effective, but often exacerbates addiction. So providing supports for people to get treatment, but not coercively, is what the American Medical Association and other medical bodies agree with. But I think the impulse, the hostility toward people who are clearly falling apart and in public view stirs, I think, a kind of fear and anxiety in people that then gets translated into a kind of punitive response enlisting the police to punish them, that makes them not responsive to the data on this that show overwhelmingly that a police response worsens the situation of drug addiction.
Oh, and it's spectacularly so in Oregon, where people also are not putting up the money to hire public defenders. There's a Oregon, the payment here is notorious in the legal community for being a fraction of what it is in all our neighboring states. And they're simply not the public defenders. And one immediate consequence is that people sometimes arrested for very serious crimes have to be cut loose. There's simply not enough lawyers to represent people for large crimes, let alone for these, quote, small type possession crimes that we want to recriminalize. So that means people will be stuck in jail, stranded, and suffer all the consequences you describe without anyone effectively defending them and making the overall problems thus steadily worse.
In concluding, I wanted to talk a little bit about our DA, Mike Schmidt, who's progressive and has supported ballot measure 110, has also called in response to this backlash, and I think threats to his own survival in the next election cycle, has called for a partial, he doesn't call it recriminalizing, but it does sound like recriminalizing, going back to misdemeanor for public drug use, making it easier to charge drug dealing. What's your take on his response to this crisis and threat to Measure 110?
Well, you have to like Mike Schmidt because of his enemies. And the police officers spread lies about what crimes he will or won't actually prosecute. They attack him and they blame all the ills of recent crime and punishment on Mike Schmidt. But having said that, I think he's wrong. I think the efforts he's taking may be tactically wise as a politician. I'm really not qualified to say whether it's a smart move or not on his part, but I think any effort to recriminalize, to make this problem a law enforcement problem, it's been shown to have absolutely no effect and to make everything worse for decade after decade after decade. You know, we've been doing a war on drugs for 50 years, and the rate of deaths with overdoses is now 10 times higher than it was when we started this war. In every way, it's been a disaster. It needs to be removed from the whole criminal justice system in order for us to have a chance at actually solving or minimizing it.
And, you know, just a final note on that front. I think declaring a new law of this scope and ambition, facing the hurdles of the health crisis, the housing crisis, the pandemic, all at once, and then in a year or two, declaring it of no use is suspiciously premature. You know, in Portugal, they decriminalized drugs, you know, 20 years ago, and it's now declared a victory, even by conservatives, apparently, in Portugal. And that's different circumstances there, of course. But these are, as you said, complex problems that require us building and expanding our social welfare system, addressing other inequities that make people vulnerable to these highly addictive drugs. But to abort this law at this point seems really driven by other conservative interests that, as you said, enlist a kind of libertarian impulse as well.
I think that's true, Jen. It's very well said. We need to give this time.
Okay, so we will also give it time. We'll keep coming back to it and hopefully hold Mike Schmidt's feet to the fire around this, because, you know, he obviously faces daunting challenges, but needs our support, but to have him hold to the principles that got him elected.
That was Jen Hocken and Mike Snedeker unraveling the complexities of drug abuse and the policy choices we face. You are listening to KBOO Portland, and I'm Patricia Kohlberg, your host. We are truly blessed to have a vibrant, listener-supported, and volunteer-run community radio station in Portland going strong after more than five decades. But we need your support. If you give today, your donation will be matched dollar for dollar by a generous group of KBOO supporters. Don't pass up this opportunity to double your dollars and help us reach our goal of $55,000. To donate, you can go to kboo.fm/give, text KBOO to 44321, or click on the donate button on your KBOO app. Next up, Bill Resnick interviews teacher, author, and education activist Jennifer Berkshire about the long history of right-wing attempts to roll back or privatize public education. A well-educated and informed citizenry is the foundation of democracy, and that's exactly what corporate elites fear most. Here's Bill with Jennifer Berkshire.
Hi, Jennifer Berkshire. Welcome to KBOO.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jennifer Berkshire writes about education and politics for The Nation, The New Republic, The Washington Post, Rethinking Schools, and other publications. The creator and co-host of the education podcast, Have You Heard? She teaches aspiring journalists at Boston College, the Labor Studies program at UMass Amherst, and Yale. She wrote the book, A Wolf at the Schoolhouse Door, The Dismantling of Public Education and the Future of School. This exposes those who, for the last 50 years, have sought to privatize the public schools. Her latest book, The Education War, A Citizen's Guide and Defense Manual, it'll be published next year, discusses how the progressive community can defeat the hard right that in the last few years in some states, that is, states with radical right-wing legislatures and governors like Florida and Texas, they banned teaching on race history, also banned any books and lessons sympathetic to LGBTI people, and they threatened with prison teachers that disobey these laws. That's in the hard right states. But also in all states, this radical right have funded organizers that have built parent groups that are ready to attack teachers, schools, and school districts that commit these intellectual sins. Jennifer Berkshire has thus studied and written about the two major threats to public education we now face and how progressives have fought them and are still being fought. That's what we'll talk about today. So, Jennifer, first we have to describe the enemies of public education from the privatizers to today's right-wing attacks, how they operate, their aims, their strategies, the different social forces they represent, and how, with all their differences, they might be helping one another.
Well, when our last book, which came out in 2020, was getting ready to reach the world, we were doing putting the final touches on it in terms of copy editing. And what was becoming obvious at that point was that the pandemic and the school shutdowns were going to present a tremendous opportunity for a certain brand of libertarian conservatives who really, since the days of Milton Friedman, had been arguing for school vouchers. And so schools had barely shut down before the Heritage Foundation sends out, you know, what was meant to look like an official government report encouraging states to immediately restructure the way that they fund schools, give some portion of money directly to the parents in the form of what they call education savings accounts. And so then we fast forward through the pandemic, and here we are today when, schools are long reopened. In some states, they weren't closed for very long at all. And I think most people would identify the ferocious culture wars as the biggest threats to public schools right now. And we're seeing that the exact same policy item is being basically rammed through in all these states. And so for me, it was a real wake-up call how, you know, like this very old idea just gets sort of rolled back out as soon as there's any opportunity to do that. And so what we're seeing right now is that in state after state, you have conservative legislators enacting what are called universal voucher programs. And the idea there is that any parent, no matter how wealthy they are, can get public funding to send their kids not just to private schools, but to basically purchase any education-related product. And so you can just go to Amazon and purchase things and call it school. And so this is happening fast. It's happening in multiple states. And it is going to present a major, major threat to public schools in those states because these universal voucher programs are enormously expensive, and they're being rolled out at a time when these same states are also slashing taxes on the wealthy. So that's what I want people to just start by wrapping their heads around, that we've got an old idea that has come rushing back to the fore and is being adopted at a scale that we've never seen before.
I don't think I understood the scope of the problem. But what I have read a good deal of is how the privatizers, their growth has greatly slowed, some because they expect big salaries for themselves, that they do it by skimping on teacher salaries or maintaining big classes or hiring unqualified people, or to set up religious or conservative schools. That they all discovered that it's not so easy to hire teachers or show high test scores. And then they try to pressure parents of children who are not good test takers, pressure them to go to another school so that they can show high scores in the tests, which in fact they can't do even after kicking out a lot of kids. And then the parents complain and the entrepreneurs are stuck in scandal. And further, the reasons for replacing public schools were found to be false. This is one of their contentions, that because test scores in math and science for U.S. kids was way below Japanese kids, even that's not exactly right, and other East Asians, that for sure the U.S. would be outcompeted in developing all the new technologies, and the U.S. would become a second-rate nation. Of course, it turned out that it was the U.S. kids who spent much time, less time in schools and public schools. They had more time for independent reading, for puttering around, for experimenting, and they made the great discoveries. It came to be known that spending 12 months a year, 10 hours a day in school does not give it a chance to develop creativity or invention. Do those failings of the privateers and the charter schools and other inventions for destroying the public system, have those in fact created problems, or is that sort of a pipe dream that I've managed to generate?
I thought you described that really well. If you go back sort of decade after decade, you can see how the case, you know, the argument for why it's urgent that we dismantle our public system and replace it with a private system, how it's always changing. So, for example, right now, if you look at the states that I was just talking about, places like Florida and, you know, as of last week, North Carolina, Texas is a big one where the governor of that state is making just a full court press to get a private school voucher program. They'll use the language of test scores to talk about how the public schools are failing, even as they're seeking to shift kids into schools where they don't take tests or they don't measure school performance by tests. So you're sort of like, well, how's that going to work? And something similar happened with online learning, because if you go back to the pre-pandemic period, one of the pipe dreams, as you were just saying, not only is it not easy to make money off of an education product, right? Educating kids is enormously labor intensive and it's expensive. And so for many years, the dream was that if you could just move schools online, that was going to be, you know, how you cashed in. You were going to have for-profit online learning, and there would be no limit to how big classes could be. And you would even hear Democratic type reformers like an Arnie Duncan, who was Barack Obama's education chief, making the case that, you know, wouldn't it be great if we could just get one really, really good teacher and have that teacher educate a whole bunch of kids online. Well, what happened? Schools shut down during the pandemic. Whatever idealism we had about online learning evaporated within, say, a week. And that sales pitch really evaporated. I predict that you'll see it start to come back relatively quickly. But you're absolutely right. We can go back to the 1980s with the Reagan era report, A Nation at Risk. And that's when you really start to hear this drumbeat that American kids are falling behind. And as a result, we are going to fail to compete internationally. And the claims that were made were often very specific. I remember reading one. Somebody was saying, you know, that the reason that Japanese automakers were going to outcompete their American counterparts was because their auto workers were more literate than U.S. auto workers. The push then was for charter schools. And so the problem, I think, now is that the vision of school choice that I was describing, these universal school vouchers, they're virtually unregulated. There's no accountability. There's no way to tell how the kids are doing, where the money is going, et cetera. And so then you wonder, well, how are they also going to make the argument about international competition when they're pushing kids into this completely unregulated marketplace? And I think that's really the big mystery.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour for KBOO Radio 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon, talking to Jennifer Berkshire, a journalist, a teacher of journalism, a specialist in schools, has written two books and countless articles. You know, with incomes going down for the bottom 70-80% of the people and life getting more precarious, there's an enormous pressure for families that are not eating very well with kids in poverty to use the money to eat and also use the kids' labor surreptitiously. It seems to me we've created conditions that are a modern Dickensian industrial state, although it's service industries, fast food that absorbs so many teenagers, as well as real teenagers, as well as kids with fake IDs. I think kids have become...
You're absolutely right.
There's so much economic pressure on them, not to mention the people who have really become demoralized and are dependent on psychoactive substances. Indeed, in Dickinson's England, the men stayed out of the factories. They sent their kids and women, and they... did odd jobs and had good times in the pub. And the limited funds came in from the kids who rebelled, of course. And the ones who resorted to force, the kids, had their teeth filed down. One of the ways that the kids never had any cavities. They also couldn't chew. It was very brutal, but we have our own version of it right now.
It's such a good point because, you know, we really forget. We get caught up in the minutiae of education policy and these debates about, you know, what kind of school should it be and what kind of training should the teacher have to have. But, you know, we have public education in this country because capitalism was so out of control. It was introduced as a way of making the world less wildly unequal. And one fascinating thing that I learned in my research was that the very first parents' rights crusade in this country was in opposition to the effort to ban child labor. And you think, why would that be? And just as we see all sorts of deep-pocketed conservative groups lining up behind the parents' rights cause today, in the 1920s, you had something similar. You had conservative industry groups that were actually really opposed to the idea that kids would have to go to school, because as they saw it, inequality was the natural state of things, and that by requiring every family to send their kids to school, the state was basically putting its thumb on the scale in the interest of equality. And these industry leaders didn't like that. And so they started up all kinds of AstroTurf groups with names like, you know, Farmers and Parents United. They pushed back really hard against the idea of banning child labor and putting that ban into the Constitution. And there was enough concern at the time about government overreach that that's the reason why we don't have a ban on child labor as an amendment to our Constitution. But I think it's so important for people to remember what the country looked like at the time when public education emerged as a progressive era reform, and what kind of future that people who are now so intent on dismantling it, what do they see? And it is absolutely not a coincidence that the very same states that are enacting these unregulated school voucher programs, that are telling wealthy parents, you know what, we're going to now pick up the tab for your private school tuition, that those same states are also rolling back any kind of regulation on child labor. And it's almost like they are trying to enact that bleak future that you described, that sort of Dickensian vision, where they say, you know what, we know there are going to be a lot of families, if they're given a sum of money and life is really hard, it's going to make more sense to send, you know, little Jenny to work. And also, you know, we can never forget the original vision of school vouchers that Milton Friedman, the economist, pushed for so long. His original vision was that the ultimate cost would be borne by the parents themselves. And so think about what that's going to look like. And you're going to have a lot of families that just say, you know what, I can't pay for it. And so I think it just makes more sense to send our kids to work instead.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour for Cable Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, talking to Jennifer Berkshire, education journalist. You heard part one of the two-part interview, whose second part will conclude on how to fight that right-wing attack today. Today we discuss voucher systems, and voucher systems, of course, the state provides a money grant to parents of school-aged children to use as they see fit, which attracts businessmen and entrepreneurial types seeing a big pot of money that they would control. In part two, to be broadcast next week, Jennifer and I discuss today's right-wing attacks on the schools. The right claiming that the schools are indoctrinating and debauching our children by feeding them hate America first propaganda from the far leftists and communists. They also claim that public schools in your town are promoting and even grooming our children for what the right considers sexual perversion. The right also claims that present school curriculums make our children feel guilty and unable to learn in school because of the teaching about slavery and racism. In that part, too, we discuss how ordinary people, not surprisingly, they're not buying those arguments and they're fighting back. And that with some imagination and resources, we can build a powerful parents' movement supporting public education. That's next week, 9 a.m. on the Old Mole Variety Hour.
That was Bill Resnick with Jennifer Berkshire with part one of their discussion about the right-wing assaults on public schools. Education, of course, does not end outside the schoolhouse doors. Part of our mission here at KBOO is to keep you educated and informed about those issues that matter the most to you. It's the last week of our fall fundraising drive, and right now your donation will be matched dollar for dollar up to $14,000 by a generous group of donors. You can donate by going to kboo.fm/give, texting KBOO to 44321, or by clicking on the donate button on your KBOO app. Labor actions are exploding across the country, and workers are winning historic concessions. To recognize the ongoing struggles, we look back at an historic battle of mine workers in West Virginia who managed to forge alliances across race and nationalities. Movie Mole's Joe Clement and Jan Hocken review John Sayles' film, Matewan, which is a fierce tribute to workers everywhere who oppose capitalist greed and exploitation. The movie is available at the Multnomah County Library. This review originally aired on March 12, 2018.
John Sayles' 1987 film, Matewan, is a dramatic retelling of the circumstances surrounding the 1920 Battle of Matewan, or Matewan Massacre, one of the first of several armed struggles between workers and mercenaries working for the coal companies in the hills of West Virginia. It stars Chris Cooper as Joe Kenahan, an organizer from United Mine Workers, who arrives by train in Matewan in the middle of an incipient strike by local miners facing wage cuts and price hikes by the company who practically owns the town, Stone Mountain. The train he is on is carrying would-be African-American and Italian miners in a freight car in back, unwittingly brought in to break the strike. One of them, a genial but commanding man named Few Clothes, played by James Earl Jones, later helps to unite the African-American contingent and the local miners. Joe finds a place to stay with miner widow Elma Radner, played by Mary McDonnell. Her son Danny, played by a 17-year-old Will Oldham, is a miner, a unionist, and an aspiring preacher. He immediately takes to Joe and more than once uses his time at the pulpit to sermonize about labor struggles through the register of Bible stories. At a secret miner meeting, Joe argues against the violent exhortations of a company spy named C.E. Lively, played by Bob Gunton. After Few Clothes shows up saying he wants to join the union, Joe convinces the white locals to bring the strike breakers into the union, which adds strength to the strike and motivates the company to send in hired mercenaries of the Baldwin Phelps Agency. As the Baldwins try to take over the town by gun, they are thwarted by the pro-union local lawman Sid Hatfield, played by David Strathairn, and the mayor. After a failed attempt by the company spy to ruin Joe's reputation by framing him as a rapist, gives the organizing efforts a further boost, reinforcements show up to evict strikers whether the town leaders like it or not. The murder of a teenage miner draws Sid, the mayor, and all the town's gun-wielding miners into the infamous Matewan Massacre that left more company men than miners dead. There's a lot going on in this film, Jan, but I had the idea to suggest this when in the last week the West Virginia teachers strike concluded, and there is a lot of reflection about West Virginia history. And we also know that shortly after Donald Trump was elected, there was a lot made out of the reactionary history of West Virginia and the essentially conservative culture of West Virginians. And there's a lot of struggle around how that history accurately reflects these, you know, historic battles between miners and companies.
Yeah, there are different stories of coal miners that have circulated in the culture, and John Sayles himself said in traveling through West Virginia this idea of making the film of Matewan because he was so impressed and moved by a certain dignity and stoicism in that part of the country, what he described as resignation about how dark and dirty and cold and wet and dangerous it was, and the pride that they were the people to do it and do it well. That's a quote from John Sayles. And economist Paul Krugman turned to the history of the coal miners after the 2016 election and wrote about the symbolism of coal mining in Appalachia and in the larger American narratives of manhood, and how ironic it was that Donald Trump won overwhelming support in West Virginia, even though that state has lost and never will regain the coal industry as it was 50 years ago. He said, quote, Donald Trump successfully pandered to cultural nostalgia, to a longing for a vanished past when men were men and miners dug deep, unquote. And I think it would be good to talk about that role of nostalgia and how you represent this history that's been so repressed in terms of the militancy of it and its importance in the larger struggle of unionism and the potential on the left as well to romanticize that period. What's your take on Mate One and whether Sales did romanticize that period that was based on a historic coal miner strike in West Virginia?
Well, I think that depends on what you mean by nostalgia. There's a lot of history behind the events in this movie, and the way that he decides to tell this story is both trying to report that history, but then also, I think, interrupt what, from his own perspective, are the problems of the history of labor in this country. Some of that has to do with masculinity, and especially its tendency towards a certain kind of force and violence, especially around guns. But even the idea of the industrial workers of the world, which shows up very early in this movie as a internal reference to nostalgia, where he says, "I ran with the Wobblies," and this other miner says, "Yeah, I did too, back when that meant something." And there's this sense of, in the film, it's worked through, you know, what does our memory do for us as far as moving forward?
And the film opens with a very compelling scene of a miner with a mining axe, and during a period when coal was more easily mined on one level, but then you see just this palpable closeness and enclosure of the mine itself and digging for coal, and you hear this cough, the cough of the coal miner, and this sense of the tremendous physical vulnerability of these men, and even the pacifism, I think, of the lead character, the heroic character who refused to fight with guns, suggests, I think you're right, a different vision of masculinity. There's a lot about the vulnerability of men. It challenges the fantasy of an earlier muscular manhood that Trump plays off of the proud coal miner, and usually as a defender of a very small circle of people, his family, versus the struggles here of finding common ground. And I guess you could say that is part of what makes it forward-looking rather than nostalgic in the sense of trying to recover a bygone era that's never going to return, that it does take up some of what's difficult in people coming together. Although, you know, maybe it oversimplified some of that idea of one big union.
Yeah, that's part of what Joe Kenahan's character is channeling, is maybe naivete is a word we might use to describe this vision of a nonviolent labor movement. Though the IWW itself was often cast as this like extreme terroristic organization, and the word sabotage suggests like a violent destruction of equipment or something along those lines, when in the IWW's own history, they adamantly said, no, our idea of sabotage has to do with our capacity to labor and the withdrawal of labor power, and that is sabotaging the machine. And that tension is at the heart of the labor movement long before even the events of Mate One.
Yeah, I think it'd be good to talk some about the rape story in the film in Mate One that becomes a kind of test of how much movement could be divided around this story meant to discredit Kenahan, who was a leftist come in as an organizer, so he was somewhat of an outsider, but was he in this community or not? And the way in which he was set up to be defeated on the basis of a charge he had raped this woman. And she had been manipulated politically to promote a false story that he had raped her. And I think it does raise some interesting questions that I think some feminists would not like that scene, because she was She was giving a false story to discredit a man. So it's much more a story about competing visions of honor among men than it was a woman's story. But it did, I think, draw out how much rape stories have been part of the political currency of our history. Certainly black men being falsely accused, men being accused to serve some other purpose among, you know, struggles among men. I think there was also in that scene and other scenes where there's some question of Joe Canahan attracting women coming into town, there's some of the conventions of the Western where the righteous cowboy comes into town. He has some seductive interactions with women, but he remains very single and unattached. This is Jan Hawken and Joe Clement talking today about John Sayles' important film of the 1980s, Mate One. Well, Joe, we were talking earlier about this distinction between nostalgia as a conservative, kind of politically regressive, we might say, emotion or sentiment versus reclaiming forgotten history and what we might call social memory, the importance of recovering the parts of our past that have been denied or repressed in the larger culture. So what about some of that memory of the painful divisions that have been part of the union movement? That did the film make too easy the process of overcoming the conflicts between white workers seeing a trainload of scabs being brought in who are black workers, and how that the bitterness of that part of our racialized history, and also immigrants or Italian workers. And there were a number of places where they played different music, but it achieved a kind of harmony pretty quickly. What about that? The promise of harmony too quickly, does a film suffer from that form of romanticizing?
Well, there's only so much that you can fit into a movie. And John Sayles' point, I think, is essentially true, which is that solidarity across racial lines is what made the union movement successful and what will make it successful. Today, what we need to look for as far as success in the labor movement is also unity across industrial or occupational lines, such as we saw in the West Virginia teacher strike, which was really probably more accurately described as a public worker strike led by teachers, because there were many other job classifications that participated. And it is a large part of why we're even talking about this film today.
Yeah, and I think the teacher's strike also defied many of the stereotypes that circulate in this country of hill people, Appalachians as backward, frozen in time. And many of them thrived even in liberal or circulating in liberal political discourse out of the outrage about how popular Trump was and how in West Virginia, and how these are the very people that depend so heavily on the federal government and support through government programs, who bought into this line about being independent of the government. And so I think this is a kind of redemptive moment for West Virginia and these young people, or the generations that followed the miners, most of whom are very old and infirmed. The survivors have children who carry this long memory of the miner struggles, and some of the signifiers were on display during the strike.
Well, and many of these institutions are themselves just generational in how they're operated. Your grandpa was a miner, you are, or your grandfather was a teacher and now you are, or someone worked in the school and now you do. There's more than just a story there. There's an actual practical, like, interest that goes across the generations, holding down these important institutions like the schools.
And most of the employment in West Virginia is not in the mines. It's a very small percentage of the workforce there. And so teachers, healthcare workers, public sector workers are not only an important part of employment, but it is an area where people can come together around a common vision of the collective good.
Yeah, I think it's important, again, to stress how teachers won a raise for all state workers, and that is itself a victory against a very popular anti-union narrative, which is that union workers of whatever occupation we're identifying as the union, the teachers' union in this case, are trying to secure benefits and their interests at the expense of other workers, or that there is this competition among public workers because they all draw from the same budget. And that was part of the governor and the legislature's kind of rhetorical play against the unions when they conceded, was that, okay, we'll give you this raise, but it's going to come out of the hide of all of these other vulnerable populations. And that is yet to be materialized. And it was one of the teachers' planks that this funding come from some other source, their suggestion being the natural gas industry that is starting to supplant the coal industry as the fossil fuel profit engine there.
And these are also people who've lived with the healthcare effects of massive deregulation that preceded even the Trump administration's intensifying of deregulation of the coal industry, and see the reality of the effects over time of the health issues, environmental issues, as well as loss of employment associated with this right-wing agenda. So Mate One is a very timely film, and John Sayles, a left-wing filmmaker of considerable note for other works, has written a book about the making of the film, and that's also, I think, worth taking a look at. And you can get the DVD. It's not available video on demand, but and it is available at one or two places in Portland. It is available at the public library and also at Clinton Street Video, one of the few remaining video stores, independent video stores in town.
Yeah, that book is called Thinking in Pictures, The Making of the Movie Mate One. You can get that at the library. I actually have the copy right here, so you should
put it
on hold. This has been Joe Clement and Jan Hawken talking about John Sayles' 1987 film Mate One for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
And that's a wrap for our show today. Our thanks to Moles Jan Hawken, Mike Snedeker, Bill Resnick, and Joe Clement for their contributions, and to Denise Morris for her editing assistance. A special thanks to our guest, Jennifer Berkshire, and a shout-out to the hardworking KABU staff keeping it all going behind the scenes. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I've been your host for the hour. Our fall membership drive is coming to an end, and we need your support. 80% of KABU operating funds come from listeners like you. Donate today and double your dollars through a match up to $14,000 provided by a generous group of supporters. If you aren't a member, consider becoming one. If you're a monthly contributor, consider increasing your monthly donation. Give whatever you can to keep community radio alive in Portland. You can donate by going to kboo.fm/give. Texting KBOO to 44321, or clicking on the donate button on your KBOO app.
Oh, beautiful hills of Galilee.
I'm going to leave you with one more song from the soundtrack to Mate One, Hills of Galilee, sung by Hazel Dickens. Thanks for listening.
Savior dwells, your flowers that bloom so beautifully, and heaven's lasting.